We're going to continue our worship together now by turning in the Bible to the first book of Kings, chapter 16, reading from verse 21. 1 Kings chapter 16 from verse 21, it's on the page 352 of the Old Testament of the Church Bibles. You'll find a Church Bible in the, or underneath one of the seats in front of you, or not very far away. If there's not one immediately there, I'm sure someone will pass one to you if you can't reach it for yourself. The first book of Kings. It's right in the middle of the Old Testament, and it's part of a chronological sequence, looks like a historical sequence of events that happened in the land of Israel, God's promised land, God's chosen people, during the years, the centuries before Jesus was born. There are two books, 1st and 2nd Samuel, and then 1st and 2nd Kings. And Samuel really tells the story of how David became Israel's first proper king, King Saul before him, but he was displaced and David took his place and was promised by God that one of his successors would reign forever after him. And then the second book of Samuel and the first and second books of Kings describe how that promise was kept. It lists each of the kings of Israel. Shortly after David's reign, the land of Israel split into two halves, Judah and Israel. So we have the kings of Judah and the kings of Israel, and all their names are recorded and the lengths of their reign and God's assessment of them and significant things that they did as the story of Israel's history unfolds in front of us. And we're going to break into the middle of that story to read the events that revolve around not just a king, but a prophet called Elijah, who will appear right at the end of our reading this morning in chapter 17, verse 1, and be our focus of attention, I hope, over the next few Sunday mornings as we hear about his impact on the kingdom of Israel and God's impact through him. If you're interested in dates, then where we are starting reading in chapter 16, verse 21, with King Omri of Israel, probably took place around about 830 BC. That's 830 years before Jesus was born. David ruled around 1000 BC, so we're about 150 to 200 years later in the passage that we're reading about, and the book of Kings itself goes right on to the end of the history of the kings of Israel and Judah, which happened around 500 BC, 580 BC perhaps. So we're right in the middle of the history of the kings of Israel. And this is the word of God in 1 Kings chapter 16, verse 21, where it tells us that the people of Israel were divided. Some of them wanted to make Tibni, son of Ginath, king, and others were in favor of Omri. But in the end, those in favor of Omri won, Tibni died, and Omri became king. So, in the 31st year of the reign of King Asa of Judah, Omri became king of Israel, and he ruled for 12 years. In the first 6 years, he ruled in Tirzah, and then he bought the hill of Samaria for 6,000 pieces of silver from a man named Shemer. Omri fortified the hill, built a town there, and named it Samaria after Shemer, the former owner of the hill. Omri sinned against the Lord more than any of his predecessors. Like Jeroboam before him, he aroused the anger of the Lord, the God of Israel, by his sins and by leading the people into sin and idolatry. And everything else that Omri did and all his accomplishments are recorded in the history of the kings of Israel. Omri died and was succeeded, was buried in Samaria, and his son Ahab succeeded him as king. In the 38th year of the reign of King Asa of Judah, Ahab, son of Omri, became king of Israel, and he ruled in Samaria for 22 years. He sinned against the Lord more than any of his predecessors. It was not enough for him to sin like King Jeroboam. He went further and married Jezebel, the daughter of King Ethbaal of Sidon, and worshipped Baal. He built a temple to Baal in Samaria, made an altar for him, and put it in the temple. And he also put up an image to the goddess Asherah. He did more to arouse the anger of the Lord, the God of Israel, than all the kings of Israel before him. During his reign, Hiel from Bethel rebuilt Jericho, and as the Lord had foretold through Joshua, son of Nun, Hiel lost his eldest son Abiram when he laid the foundation of Jericho, and his youngest son Segub when he built the gates. A prophet named Elijah from Tishbe in Gilead said to King Ahab, "In the name of the Lord, the living God of Israel, whom I serve, I tell you that there will be no dew or rain for the next 2 or 3 years until I say so." Amen. And I pray that God would follow with his blessing this reading from his word. I suspect that if when it came to election time, there was a candidate who came along and promised to be able to unite all the different factions within the country that were potentially tearing the nation apart, and also promised to be able to deal with a very real threat of invasion from neighboring countries, and at the same time to be able to establish a positive balance of trade that would earn income for the country, as well as having the resources to be able to reform the whole administration of government and deal with inefficiency, as well as being able to lead the nation just in general into a period unprecedented in living memory of wealth and prosperity. Someone came along at election time who promised to be able to do all of that, then we would be more likely to score them off our list of potential candidates than to vote for them, because we've heard those kinds of promises before and we do not really believe that they could be kept. Who could be man enough for a task like that? But in fact, those kinds of claims in the context that we're thinking about this morning were not made in an election manifesto prior to the vote itself and the person being entrusted with power. They're actually made in the political history written after that candidate's time in office. And they record one of the most successful periods of power imaginable. If you're able to read the history of the kings of Israel that is referred to in chapter 16, verse 27, which talks about all the other accomplishments of King Omri, nobody can read that because the work has been lost, but from other ancient historical sources, we've got a fair idea of what it might have contained. If you've been able to read that history of the kings of Israel, you would read about King Omri, who succeeded in ending a civil war in Israel and drove back the invading Moabites in the east of the country and managed to form a successful trading partnership with the wealthy people of Tyre and Sidon by marrying his son to their king's daughter, and built this new capital city of Samaria, which allowed him to rule the country effectively and with strength, and through the effectiveness of his reign managed to earn the respect of the Assyrians further to the north of Israel, who were emerging at that time in the political and military world of the ancient Near East as the local regional superpower in the 8th century BC, and as far as they were concerned, King Omri was someone who had to be reckoned with. So by all of these measures, he was a good king. He achieved many of the kinds of things that Christians are praying for today, not just for our own nation, but perhaps more especially for other parts of the world that are troubled by war, being torn apart by violence, suffering from hunger, not able to make the most of the opportunities that creation has presented them with. If only there could be more kings like Omri around, we think, or presidents or prime ministers, to put countries back on their feet. then the world would surely be a better place. And yet, if you read the Bible, as we have just done about King Omri, you do not find that he is praised for those achievements. You have to go to these other historical sources to find King Omri's reign being appreciated. The Bible's verdict is very much simpler. It says, King Omri sinned against the Lord, verse 25, much more than any of his predecessors. He aroused the anger of the Lord, the God of Israel, by his sins and by leading the people into sin and idolatry. Now, at this point, we need to step just a little bit back from the story and understand what the Book of Kings is that we're reading from the Bible at the moment. The two books of Kings are not really history books at all. They do, in fact, record names and dates of kings and other significant people and the battles that they fought and the victories that they won and the decisions that they made. But that's not why the books of Kings are written. In fact, it tells us there is already a history of the kings of Israel to which you can refer if you want to know those facts and figures. The books of Kings are, in fact, sermons preached by a man of God or a prophet or some other person, using this as background information to illustrate the truth. But sermons preached about God and his relationship with his people. Not preached to the people at the time, not preached to King Omri or King Ahab or even to their subjects, but preached to people perhaps 300 or 500 years later. The original readers of this book or hearers of this sermon, and by extension preached to us today. And certainly that original author, and us if we care to do the research, those original readers or hearers, and us if we'd care to do the research today, we would know of Omri's reputation. We would know that he was an effective ruler and a high achiever and someone who has to be admired. So what the preacher is saying to us when he describes King Omri is this: he is saying, I know what you think of him. I know what you've heard about him, but you're wrong. You've misunderstood him. You've missed the point. Because the Bible's verdict is that Omri sinned against the God and misled the people. And by, in that way, cutting across our expectations, exposing the truth about him, it makes us stop and think again. It would make students of history stop and think again about King Omri. And if the effectiveness or reputation of 8th century BC kings of Israel, 9th century BC kings of Israel, matters to you, then perhaps that's significant. But more importantly, it makes us stop and think again about ourselves and the world in which we live, about the people whom we admire, the high flyers and the high achievers, and the standards by which we judge them. Because the point is that if we would have thought that King Omri was good for himself and good for his people, and we're so wrong about that, then isn't there a danger that in the way we think about ourselves and our own situation, we're wrong again? Because we fail to see things from God's perspective and to understand the importance of what it is that really matters. So right from the outset, the author or the preacher in the Book of Kings is saying to us that it's not the stripes on our arm or the feathers in our caps or the years of service that we have given or the lists of achievements that we can look back on or the money that we have earned or even the money that we have given away or the friends that we have made, or the enemies that we have overcome, or the titles before our names, or the letters after them, that God finds impressive. God isn't sitting there thinking of me or thinking of you, what a wonderful person you must be because of all these things. And while others might applaud them, and encourage us to aim for them. The danger is that, remember those hypocrites Jesus criticized in the Sermon on the Mount, who enjoyed the people's praise? But once their applause had come to an end, they had received their reward in full and amassed no share of the treasures in heaven. So that's what the preacher is saying to us. He's saying, think again about your values and what you respect and what you aim for and what you think you're worth. So where, according to the Bible, does Omri go wrong? Well, in verse 26, it tells us he went wrong by leading the people into idolatry. And idolatry is very simply having something or someone else in the place in our lives where God should be. As human beings, we are made to worship, that is, to admire someone or something, to have a focus for our lives, a purpose for our lives. And when our highest admiration or our greatest respect is given to somebody other than God, whether it's ourselves and we become self-centered, or whether we become focused on our career or some other aspect of our lives, whenever that happens, it is idolatry. And the problem becomes with us that God is no longer the reason for what we do, and God's ways are no longer the way that we do it. When that happens, you are guilty of idolatry. But the specific form of idolatry which we can safely presume preoccupied Omri emerges more clearly as we move into his son and successor, King Ahab. King Omri, in verse 25, we are told, sinned against the Lord more than any of his predecessors, but King Ahab, Omri's son, we are told, also sinned against the Lord, in effect, even more than Omri. You think Omri was bad? You should have seen Ahab. He was even worse. And the extra awful that Ahab did, under the influence of his foreign bride, Jezebel, was in verse 31 that he worshipped Baal, not just quietly or secretly, because in verse 32, he built a temple to Baal and he made an altar for him. Way off in Jerusalem, the capital city of Judah, the other half of God's people, there was a temple to the Lord with the Ark of the Covenant where the priests serviced the temple of God and the altar there. And Ahab said, I've got my new capital city here that my dad built. I need a temple too. So he imitated what was done in Jerusalem, but instead of an altar to the living God, he built an altar to Baal in the temple of Baal there. And for that reason, says the Bible, he was even worse than Omri. So, with apologies for the spelling, what was so bad about Baal? Well, Baal was essentially a fertility god, the same kind of god as many of the other nations around about Israel would have been worshipping at this time, a god who was thought to control the power of nature. And particularly for a largely agricultural community, that was important power to have. If you wanted your fields to produce a harvest, then you had to offer a sacrifice to Baal, and that would make the rain fall and the crops grow. If you wanted your wife to have a baby, or a large number of babies, again, you had to offer a sacrifice to Baal, and he is the one who would give the gift of new or recurring or repeating life. So essentially, wealth and sex and family and prosperity were all tied up with the worship of Baal. If you offered the right sacrifices, he would come up with the goods. Now you might say, what's so terribly wrong with that? Because it sounds in many ways very similar to the God whom we worship. After all, we know that it's God who sends the rain to fall and the sun to shine. It's God whose harvest we give thanks for. at our annual Harvest Thanksgiving celebration. And it's God whose miraculous gift of life we celebrate every time a baby is born. To be sure, we know that Israel's first command of the Ten Commandments was that you shall have no other gods beside me, and that would seem to knock Baal out of the reckoning to begin with. But why not, instead of being so appalled at what was being done in Samaria, why not just pull the kind of clever trick that people are so fond of pulling today and say this, that Baal is not really another god, just another name for God. And what does it matter whether you call him Allah or Krishna or Christ or something else? Surely what is important, once you've taken out a few cultural twists and turns and resolved a few linguistic difficulties and overcome your own racial prejudices, surely all gods are basically the same, and what matters is that we have our faith in them and then are ready to respect the faith of others. That is contemporary wisdom today, and it's probably the policy that both Omri and Ahab found so profitable. They saw to themselves, if we worship the Lord, the living God, the God of Israel, then we'll be isolated. And those people of Tyre and Sidon over there who've got so much money and worship Baal will have nothing to do with them. But if we start to call our God Baal and call our temple the temple of Baal, well, then all these barriers between us fall away. We don't need to be different from them. We don't need to be at war with them. Instead, we can trade with them and we can enjoy a share of their wealth. And that's what they did, and that's what happened. And average income rose and employment was full, and interest rates, if they had such things, would have been falling. And if there had been an electorate, Ahab would have won their backing again and again and again. But not the backing of God. Verse 33, Ahab did more to arouse the anger of the Lord, the God of Israel, than all the kings of Israel before him. So why did it matter so much that Ahab named his god Baal? Well, there's two crucial differences between God and Baal. The first is less obvious, perhaps. Sorry, the first is more obvious, but less critical. And it is this, that where the Lord gives graciously, Baal gives only grudgingly. That where the living God demands simply our gratitude, Baal demands payment in advance. Because the theology of Baal says that you will get no harvest from your fields and have no children born into your family unless you make the proper sacrifice first. Because Baal reigns by spreading fear. Where the real truth is that we very often only discover how kind God has been to us and how many of the fruits of his good creation we have been enjoying for years when we finally come to our senses and recognize him as the giver of the gifts. For our God is a God of love, who doesn't create us in order to pay him back, who doesn't go into business in order to exploit us for the value of our offerings or our sacrifices, but rather who brings us into business, who brings us to life in order to share his enjoyment of his creation. But it says in the Sermon on the Mount, folk often misquote it and say the sun shines on the righteous. Church outing, the sun has shone, it was because we were righteous. What Jesus said is the sun shines on the righteous and the unrighteous alike. Because God gives freely to all of us. He's that kind of God. There's no preconditions, there's no payment in advance. So whenever we slip into the way of thinking that I would be willing to bet, no, I wouldn't because I wouldn't bet, but I'd be willing to promise that everybody here must have fallen into sometimes. When we fall into that way of thinking of our religious duty, our worship, our prayer, our sacrificial giving of our time and our talents of money, whenever we think of that as a way of earning God's approval, or a way of escaping his judgment. God is bound to be good to me on Tuesday afternoon this week because I went to church on Sunday. Or God is bound to save me from, or duty-bound to save me from some painful disease because I've always said my prayers. Whenever we think of God in those terms, where what we have done for him is a guarantee of our peace and prosperity, something that makes us more worthy of blessing than perhaps other men and women are, then we have begun to worship Baal instead of the living God. Because the blessings of creation are given to us not as a reward for putting up with God, but as a gift from the God who loves us. And the blessing of knowing him and working with him are all the additional blessings that come with faith. So it's not that God gives bigger harvests or more desirable children to those who do believe rather than those that don't. It is that God gives eyes to see and to appreciate the fuller value of the harvest that we reap and the children that we have when we see things from him perspective and in partnership and in fellowship with him. So there is that danger that we see our God as a God who gives only grudgingly and upon fulfillment of certain conditions. And when that happens, we have begun to worship Baal. But there's a second problem with Baal, which matters much more. And it is this, that once the gift of fertility has come to an end, that is to say, once we have acquired the health and the wealth that we think is our due, then Baal has nothing more to offer. He's fulfilled his role and can be set aside. Because Baal has no sense of history. And Baal has no sense of eternity. And that is really why he pales into insignificance in the shadow of the living Lord, whose goal is not just that people should have a decent innings and get by with enough to eat and enough to drink in the course of their lives and then have an heir to whom they can leave their prosperity when they die. God is interested in much more than that. We have a God whose purpose is being worked out from one generation to the next and from everlasting to everlasting. We have a God who sends the rainfall and the sunshine, not just so that our bellies can be full, but so that we can have the strength and the energy to share with him in the building of a kingdom and the filling of a future and the living out of a hope. That is why our Christian faith is so firmly anchored in events that took place far away and long ago, outside a city wall in Jerusalem where Jesus Christ was crucified and rose again from the dead. That wasn't just a demonstration of how much God loves us, nor just a demonstration of how much power he has to win victory for life over death. That was God changing the history of the world. That was a crucial step in his plan from creation through redemption to final glory beyond the end of time. It was the working out of his purposes that are still being worked out in us today. And we do not have a God who simply says to us, your cupboards are full and your children are growing up and everybody's happy and healthy. What more could you want? We have a God who says, I've got much, much more that has to be done, and much, much more that I want you to be a part of, because I value your service as a critical part of my unfolding plan. And that's what was wrong with the reigns of Omri and Ahab. However cleverly they governed and however victoriously they fought and however prosperous they became, it was all ultimately self-satisfying. And their success was always going to be limited to their physical horizons and the passing of their years, because that was as far as they could see and as far as they cared about and as far as they could be effective. And that's why Baal was God enough for them, because the little that he offered was all that they were interested in. And that's why God was so appalled at their idolatry, because it reduced them to nothing more than this, and extracted them from his eternal plan. So you know, the real test of whether you and I are worshipping the living God or Baal is not really the name by which we call him, but this. The test is whether we hope that God will give us what we want. That's the worshippers of Baal. Or whether God makes us want what he can give. That's the living Lord. Baal worship dumbs us down to the wishes of the worshipper, and only grants power over these areas of our lives with which we are dissatisfied. So if we reach that situation where the things that are going well in our lives are nothing to do with God and don't feature in our prayers, then we're worshipping Baal. Because the worship of God expands our vision to share his ambition for the whole of the world and the whole of eternity over which he reigns. Baal worship only ever really says, look here, I've got a problem. I'd better go and pay God to sort it out. Whereas the worship of the living God says, I've got strength. I've got a gift. I've got resources. I've got energy. I'd better get God to tell me what they're for and show me what he wants to do with them. And that is why I believe that God has assembled here in Partick Trinity such a remarkable collection of people. Not necessarily an any more remarkable collection of people than he has assembled in the church up the road or down the street or around the corner, because any assembly of God's people is full of immense and remarkable things. But I believe that God has assembled us not just so that we can survive, not just so that we can go through the procedures of being church and meet our own needs and fulfill our own expectations. If that was our highest hope, then I believe that God would be as disgusted with us as he was with Omri and Ahab, who worshipped no more than Baal. But the living God, who reigns from everlasting to everlasting, has assembled us so that we can be and do for him vital things of eternal significance, so that we can use and exhaust all of our resources on his service, and then find these resources replenished and renewed because we are doing what he values. Not shutting ourselves away from the world, certainly not getting by without him in the world, but investing our faith in him in the world to lasting and powerful effect. And so it was only because Omri and Ahab did well only at the little things that they attempted, because that was all their little God inspired them to do, that Elijah came in chapter 17, verse 1, came to them in the name of the Lord and said, there will be no more dew or rain, no more life, no more health, no more wealth, and no more strength. There will be none of that until I say so. None of what you do expect your God to give you, until you learn to look for more besides. And Elijah introduces that struggle, which unfolds over the next three or four chapters that we'll read about over the next few Sundays, the struggle between the man of God and the prophets of Baal that culminated in fire from heaven falling in Mount Carmel, proving the strength of the living God. A struggle which goes on inside all of us all the time between the little that we are satisfied to receive from God and the much more that He wants to give. And so we need to pray that the miraculous victory we're going to go on to read about in these next few pages will be won again in our lives today. And I pray that God will follow with His blessing, the truth contained in this reading from His Word.